Hi, I'm Dr. Kathy Miller, Professor of Medicine at the Indiana University School of Medicine in Indianapolis. Welcome to Medscape Oncology Insights and the 2017 annual meeting of the American Society of Clinical Oncology. At the plenary session this year, we'll be hearing about the Olympiad trial, which looked at a PARP inhibitor in breast cancer patients with deleterious BRCA mutations. We've been waiting for this study for a long time as well, and here to talk with us about this study and provide her perspective on the use of PARP inhibitors in our breast cancer patients is one of the authors of the Olympiad trial, Dr. Susan Domchak. Susan is professor of oncology at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania and executive director of the Basser Center for BRCA at the Abramson Cancer Center, also in Philadelphia. Welcome, Susan.
Thanks for having me, Kathy.
So take us to some background first. Why would we think or hope that PARP inhibitors might be effective in women who have BRCA mutations?
Well, it's an interesting story of how understanding basic biology and understanding how tumors can develop can lead you to a very interesting and novel type of therapy. So when BRCA1 and 2 were first discovered back in 94 and 95, no one really knew what these proteins did in the cell. But as we gained understanding, we realized that they helped repair double-stranded breaks in the cell. And when you knew that, then you could say, well, how can we figure this out and how can we target it? And so in 2005, several teams published studies that showed that if you blocked a different type of DNA repair pathway with something called a PARP inhibitor, that you made the cells so unstable that they fell apart, and we call that synthetic lethality, with the basic idea that if you block one pathway, the cells can survive. If you block a second pathway only, the cells can survive. But if you block them both, the cells die. We've gained a lot more understanding about how PARP inhibitors work since then, but that basic understanding holds true. So with that information in hand, it was the next step was to take it into patients who had inherited mutations in BRCA1 and BRCA2 and to see what happens. So in 2009, we had a first readout in a phase one trial in the New England Journal of Medicine showing that these tumors could respond. And from there, we've slowly but surely gathered the evidence, culminating in this year learning about a phase three trial comparing one of the PARP inhibitors called olaparib to standard of care chemotherapy in BRCA1 and 2 carriers with metastatic breast cancer.
So these patients all had metastatic disease. Had they had previous chemotherapy, or was this their initial treatment?
So it's a great and important point. And for this particular trial, patients could have up to two lines of prior chemotherapy. So there were some patients who came in and had not yet been treated for metastatic disease, but they all had anthracyclines and taxanes at some point before getting the PARP inhibitor versus the standard of care chemotherapy.
Standard of care chemotherapy is a little hard to define when you have such
yes,
a broad
is.
Patient population. Some
sure.
receiving their first therapy, some maybe receiving their third therapy. How did the trial manage that?
Yes, and so this was a point of intense debate, and as you can imagine, whenever you're designing a clinical trial, you cannot let perfect be the enemy of the good, and we understood that this was a relatively rare patient population. So we wanted to, on the one hand, make sure the eligibility criteria were broad enough for patients to be brought into the study, and at the same time, not compromise results by having too heterogeneous of a population. So for this study, the three particular standard of care chemotherapies were defined at the outset, and they included capecitabine, fluorouracil, and eribulin as the potential choices. Patients had to have already received a taxane at some point, so the idea was that these are not patients who had not yet received a taxane, and that's quite important. So we had patients come in having received, you know, a variable number of chemotherapies. It's also important to know that patients who had estrogen receptor positive therapy were also permitted, estrogen receptor positive cancer were also allowed into the study, but they had to have received at least one hormonal therapy in the metastatic setting.
So in this comparison, I'm going to guess that olaparib did better, or it wouldn't be at the plenary session, but how much better was this?
Right. I think we've been involved in breast cancer research for a long time, and so we have been through the trials and tribulations of different drugs. And so some of the things that you want to know is how much better is it, how toxic is it, and is it a specific targeting or a more general chemotherapy effect? So I think the particularly interesting things about this research is that olaparib is not chemotherapy. It's a targeted mechanism. It's oral. Patients don't lose their hair. So we already have some advantages compared to standard chemotherapy. But what we see here is that it is better, and the primary endpoint was progression-free survival. So the hazard ratio in favor of olaparib is 0.58. And in addition, there were fewer grade 3 and 4 toxicities in the olaparib group, and there was an improvement in overall quality of life in the olaparib group. The response rate was also twice as high in the olaparib group compared to chemotherapy. So all in all, everything's pointing in a really positive direction with this drug.
So you're telling us the oncologic equivalent of light beer really does exist. It tastes great and less filling. Worked better, less toxic, better quality of life.
Yes.
What about myelosuppression? Because that has been an issue with some of the PARP inhibitors.
Absolutely. And I think one thing that we've learned is that for instance, it's very hard to combine PARP inhibitors with chemotherapy, particularly the more potent PARP inhibitors. That's just very hard to do. When olaparib is given as monotherapy, as it's seen here, anemia was actually more of a problem than neutropenia. And so these are not drugs that are without toxicity. There's nausea, potential vomiting, anemia are the main things that we're dealing with. But they can be managed by dose interruptions and dose reductions. And so I think it's really important for people to not think of this as, you know, a sugar pill. No, this is a real therapy. But just like we figured out capecitabine and how to dose reduce that and keep people on their therapy, it'll be important to have that understanding here with olaparib.
So one chemotherapy that you didn't mention were the platinums.
Did you notice?
I noticed.
Oh, rats.
But in some way, it takes advantage of the same biologic understanding. That wasn't an option among your standard of care chemotherapies. Could patients have previous platinum therapy?
Yes. So in this particular study, patients could have received platinum in the adjuvant or neoadjuvant setting as long as at least 12 months had elapsed between then and the start of the study. In addition, they could have had their platinum in the metastatic setting, but their tumors could not have progressed while they were on platinum. So the important consideration, which you raise and is very valid, is should platinum have been one of the arms? Now, we remind ourselves that platinum is not an approved treatment of metastatic breast cancer. That's not to say that we don't use it, but it's actually not an approved medication. And at the time that this study was initiated, although there were some early data regarding platinum use in BRCA1 and 2, there was not the level of study that we currently have today. So what do we do with that? How do we look at platinum versus PARP inhibitors? Platinums are not non-toxic, particularly with continuous use. People can have significant neuropathies. However, both carboplatin and cisplatin in various studies have shown very high response rates in BRCA1 and 2 mutation carriers. So we have to look at the toxicity issue, and we also have to look at this concept of overlapping resistance mechanisms. What do I mean by that? Well, we know that one of the resistance mechanisms to platinum-based therapies is reversion mutations of BRCA1 and 2, and that has also been seen to some degree with PARP inhibitors. But we don't yet have a full understanding of this intersection of PARP resistance and platinum resistance. We know that there is overlap, but we're not exactly sure of how much overlap there is. So we still have a ways to go in figuring out how to use these drugs, platinum, which is, let's face it, cheap, available, but also somewhat toxic, and these PARP inhibitors, which are less toxic, more expensive, and figuring out what we really want to know, which is what's the best thing for our patients in the long run. And so we still have work to do.
Well, I guess I was thinking of a very practical question for our listeners who are going to be thinking of treating patients.
Right.
in the time this study has been going on, we have gotten more data on the benefit of platinums in patients with known mutations and the potential increases in pathologic complete response in an early stage setting by using platinums even in unselected patients with triple negative disease.
Right.
So if I have someone with a mutation who had platinum as part of her early therapy, now with metastatic disease, is that a patient that I should be thinking about a PARP inhibitor? How many patients in the Olympiad study had had previous platinum, and did that seem to impact the results in that subset?
It was approximately 20%, and there was stratification based on that, an initial stratification analysis. We are not necessarily powered to look directly at the subset, but it doesn't look like it's the only answer to this question. So I would say if, as based on the study, they're more than a year out from their initial platinum therapy for early stage breast cancer, it would make sense to use a PARP inhibitor in that setting. I think the one place that we have to be careful that is not informed by this study but has been suggested by others, particularly ovarian studies, is when a tumor is truly refractory to platinum, when there's significant progressing of disease while that patient is still receiving a platinum-based therapy, there does seem to be a much lower response rate than if the individual had received platinum, you know, months before or years before. So that's all things that we really need to sort out and work on, but that is the one area that I would say if someone, unfortunately, their tumors have blown through your platinum-based therapy, that may not be the person to immediately put on a PARP inhibitor.
So I think our practitioners are going to have the reverse question as well, because the majority of the patients they see for whom the Olympiad trial is going to inform their care have not had a platinum.
Right.
Most of the patients I know would much rather have a pill that does not cause the alopecia and nearly as many chemotherapy side effects as a platinum. If they're now progressing on olaparib and they've never had a platinum, should I have the same concern about maybe platinum doesn't have a role to play for this patient?
I think we don't have all the information yet. There have been some data, though, from ovarian cancer that you can see responses in those settings. So I think we need to do that post-PARP analysis in more detail. And there will be some secondary analyses that will, of course, be exploratory from this study, because we did keep track of what therapies people received after their initial study indicated therapy. So I don't have the exact answer yet, but one thing I wanted to emphasize is not only were the response rates high in olaparib, in the olaparib arm, but the time to response was the same as in the chemotherapy arm. So if you will, you know, as medical oncologists treating breast cancer patients, we kind of think of hormones as, yes, they're effective, but they may take a little longer to see that response. Well, olaparib, you see the responses in the same amount of time as you see with chemotherapy. So that is actually somewhat reassuring for that BRCA1 triple negative patient, that you don't, if you will, have to give them chemotherapy necessarily up front, because we are seeing these high response rates and the same time to response as in the chemotherapy arm.
So one last practical question about olaparib. Mm-hmm. The dose was 400 milligrams twice a day. It comes in 50 milligram capsules. I can already hear my patients groaning about 8 capsules twice a day.
Yes, so the formulation has changed. So in this study, it's actually 300 milligrams twice a day in a tablet formulation as opposed to the capsule formulation. So we have made some progress on that. So they're 100 milligram tablets. And so there are fewer pills a day. But we still have, yes, we still have work to do. The tablets are
three
easier.
Twice a day is still much easier than 8.
Yes, I do. I actually have 3 patients on long for many years that are on the olaparib capsules, and they are choking those capsules down twice a day, being on it for years. Mm-hmm. But we do always have to think of how to make it easier for patients to stay adherent to their medications, and currently lowering the total number of pills taken a day is part of that picture.
Susan, thank you for coming in and sharing this really exciting news with us. It's fantastic to see the biology really coming to fruition.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
And thank you for joining us today. This is Kathy Miller reporting from ASCO 2017.